Good morning, all of you fans of food and wine and travel out there.
Can we say good afternoon to all our European friends?
Yes, we can. We can say the other one. What is it from
Australia? Well, it's you're either up very late or you're up very early. I'm not sure which it is, but it's already Monday down under, so welcome to the show once again. We're, of course, delighted to have you with us. Don't forget, you can get in touch with us anytime by email at
onthemenu at onthemenuradio.com.
And we've got another action-packed show for you today. Starting off with a fascinating, it's hard to call it a new invention, but you'll get the drift, I think, when we start talking about the, if you like, the gentrification of beer can chicken. And then following that, we're going to go back to our favorite continent, because we've still got lots of great material about Australia, and we're going to be spending the rest of this program in Queensland and northern New South Wales, geographically at least, and some very interesting characters that we met there.
And actually, there's another connection is that although they're marketing this device, this tool, kitchen tool, throughout the country, here in the U.S., they're looking to establish contacts for in exporting this beer can chicken pot, I guess it's called, to Australia, particularly.
Or to anywhere else for that matter. But they thought Australia, they thought Australia would be a great market. So if there are any listeners out there down under and you're interested in trying to promote beer can chicken into the Australian barbecue market, then you just need to get in touch with us and we'll make the connection for you. But now let's go back to listening to Tom and Carrie talk about their exciting product, Beer Can Chicken, and all the philosophy surrounding it. Peter reckons that he's pretty much the king of outdoor cooking when it comes to adventuring with new techniques and new foods and that kind of thing.
He's also very modest.
Yeah, I'm also very modest. Well, hey, when you can roast a goose outside on your Weber kettle grill on Christmas Day, you're a pretty innovative kind of guy. But one thing I had never tried was beer can chicken. I don't know whether I thought beer can chicken was too lowbrow or just exactly what it was, but I just couldn't bring myself to stick a chicken, to stick a beer can up the aperture of a chicken. But then Anne found out about this product that we're going to be talking to. Who are the guys again? I've forgotten. Anne's got the script here.
Yeah, we're going to be talking to Tom Simon, who invented the Poultry Pal, which is what it's called, and his good friend Carrie Black, who wrote the accompanying book, The Zen and the Art of Beer Can Chicken.
Now, it didn't seem to me like it was a zenny kind of thing either, and I have to say, I got the product and I was dubious to say the least, and then amazed when I put the dish on the table that it tasted so absolutely incredibly succulent. But where does the story begin, guys?
Well, I guess I'd have to start with me there, Peter. Just like you said, sticking a beer can up the butt of a chicken sounded very intriguing, and I had done it a number of times. The problems with that was I was a little concerned about possible the toxic inks and solvents, the lining of a beer can that might be permeated into the meat of the chicken. Plus, the beer can had a tendency to stick into the poultry itself, and I thought to myself, it's the old proverbial, there's got to be a better way to do this. And having done it a number of times, I drew up a prototype on the proverbial paper napkin. A friend of mine went out and actually we prototyped it, went to a food store and a cooking store. We bought a couple of pans and took it back and drilled a couple of holes and did some bending. And voila, we had our first Poultry Pal prototype.
Who would like to describe what it looks like?
Oh, I think Carrie should do that.
Okay, Carrie, away you go.
Do you have a copy of the book with you?
Oh, I do. I mean, I know exactly what it looks like. I'm just thinking, unfortunately, we don't have the power of video with our audience. So
there we go.
So if you can sort of describe the, it's only got two components, and one of them simulates the penetration of a beer can, and then the other one stores the liquid. But you can do a better job than I can.
Well, it's a two-component system. The base looks like a ordinary pie pan with some little kind of like handles on it. And then the top part is a flat disc with a tower in the center. The tower has holes on the sides that portion, the tower then emulates the beer can. That whole base sits in a recessed, or that whole system sits in a recessed fashion on the base to keep, you know, juices contained within the system. And then the chicken fits over the tower. And the result of that design then is, as you cook, the liquid in the base, the beer, the wine, the Asti Spumante, boils, and essentially the vapor then comes up through the tower and out through the holes and continually infuses the bird as it cooks. And, of course, as it cooks, the fats from the bird then drain away and come back down into the base, and you end up with what we call the continuous infusion cooking process.
Is that what it is? And you're a shy man, so you're standing or sitting a little further away from the phone. If you can, I can digital enhance you later. But if you sit closer to the phone, I'll get a little more volume. It's really absolutely amazing. The chicken comes out incredibly moist. The continuous infusion method. There you go.
Yeah. One thing I'd like to point out too, Peter and Anne, is that when you cut into the chicken after you use this infusion method, and that's why it's been so well received in the United States and around the world, because most people don't like the white meat of birds because it becomes dry. While you're waiting for the white meat or for the dark meat to cook, the white meat has a tendency to dry out. And with this system, we're actually continuing to braise that steamed liquid into the white meat so it stays moist while the legs and thighs cook.
I absolutely agree. I mean, it's an amazing thing to see. One of the most amusing things is the chicken really looks rather silly.
Yes. Actually, there's another product out there that is a ceramic chicken heads that completes the whole ensemble that actually serves another purpose, and you'll see that on both our websites. There's a ceramic chicken heads that plug the neck of the chicken. People can also use like a half of an apple or an onion or an orange to actually keep more of that liquid steam inside the bird cavity.
Yeah, and that's not your product.
No, it's somebody that we've been associated with. But like I say, it adds a very whimsical, humorous type of element to the cooking process.
Although it also probably makes it harder to fit in the oven, right?
Yeah, it can.
Yeah, mention that
the
this
oven,
can.
Grills, they have a problem fitting in grills.
Yeah. I haven't tried outside yet. I suspect that it probably would just about go with a smallish chicken. It would just about go under the hood of a 22-inch Weber. Have you tried that?
Oh, yes, absolutely. In fact, one of the best-selling, what really helps our sales is because everybody asked me with the Poultry Pound when I was coming out with one that would do a turkey. And
yeah,
if you're familiar with beer can or deep-fried turkey, everybody wanted to try doing a turkey on this. They wanted to know when I was going to come up with a product that would do a turkey. And I had to start cooking turkeys at events to show them the Poultry Pound will do everything from a Cornish game hen, a chicken, ducks, up to a full-size turkey.
See, I can't picture how it would be stable with a turkey on it.
Very easily. In Carrie's cookbook and in my booklet that's included with the unit, we actually have two different methods of doing turkey or chicken roasters. You can do it neck down over the tower, or you can do it legs down over the tower.
Right. Was I doing the right thing? I mean, I'm pretty sure I did it legs down.
Yes.
I mean, the legs on the bottom.
For the smaller birds, that's the better approach.
It seemed like the logical thing to do. Here's a question.
Now, with the turkeys, the neck down approach, I prefer, and part of that is because the aperture, for lack of a better word, on the bottom side of the turkey tends to be very big.
Yes, yeah, right.
The weight of the bird makes it somewhat top heavy, and therein is your instability. If you're going to stuff it on the bottom aperture, you kind of need to carve the back end of the turkey so it sits straight up and down. The neck hole, on the other hand, for most, you know, anywhere from 13 to 20-pound turkeys, slides very nicely over the flavor tower, and now the bird's upside down, but it's straight up and down, and so it tends to be stable.
Maybe eventually, though, you'll come out with a big mother a big mother version that will look a little more stable. I mean, it seems to me if you put a 13 to 20 pound turkey on this thing, it wouldn't look very stable, even if it turned out it was.
Yeah, actually, Peter, it actually is fairly very stable on doing it neck down. The other advantage to doing it that way is you can cut up onions and peppers and celery and actually do a little stuffing by doing that, and then sewing the or using skewers to close up the cavity, and then that those cut up vegetables steam that flavor right into the bird, and the way it's positioned on the tower, it allows the juices to drain naturally back into the breast meat.
Well, Cary, now tell us about the book.
Well, at the time Tom came up with his prototype on the cooker, I was working in the same establishment that he was, and I'd been hired to do some writing for these guys. And Tom and I were assigned to work together on the project. And Tom shared his beer can chicken cooking device, of which I'd never heard of before. I forget the exact sequence. I think he let me take it home to try it, and I fell in love with it. I just saw how neat it was. Tom hired me to write the recipes that are presented in the little booklet that goes with the Poultry Pal.
And your brother did hysterical cartoons. Pardon?
And as I proceeded, I ended up kept trying more and more recipes, and you know, before long, I had 30 some recipes, and I enlisted the aid of my father, Don, who...
Oh, that's your father?
Yeah, he's done some freelance cartooning, and Tom and I had talked about the concept. We wanted the cookbook to be easy to use with good recipes, but kind of tongue-in-cheek with a lot of humor, making it kind of a fun read in addition to just being a functional cookbook.
Well, it is that.
And so my dad has always drawn humorous cartoons and that kind of thing. It was the perfect blend between my dad, and then adding a bunch of other recipes, side dishes, sections on brining and injecting, you know, basically
you
everything
you'd
ever want
too?
To know about cooking beer can chicken, but we're afraid to ask. Kind
yeah. Do you recommend to do all of that? I mean, is it an overkill? Because it comes out pretty warm and pretty moist and flavorful anyhow.
Well, I agree. And basically what we're doing there is just creating options for folk. I've done some injecting, and certainly I tried the recipes that I wrote about. I tend to, in my normal everyday cooking, just do the straight-up chicken with the liquid in the base, just from the simplicity part of it.
Yeah, that's how I've done it so far, just a little salt and pepper and olive oil on the surface to make sure that it browns correctly and the skin goes nice and crisp. But I have a different question, because I'm not certain what to do with the liquid. And I don't like to throw things away. After all, it does have beer in it, so you can't go doing silly things like that. So the first time I did it, I served a little on my chicken, and then unfortunately Anne threw the container away. But the second time I actually kept it, I boiled down the liquid for probably about 10 minutes to concentrate it a little bit. And then I let it stand so that all the fat floated to the top. Then I took the fat off the top, and down below is this absolutely beautiful jelly, which of course I started to eat cold with a spoon until my wife once again stepped in and said I couldn't do that, and she threw that away as well.
Yeah.
So what do other people do with the liquid?
Well, I can tell you that the liquid, even freshly after cooking, invariably makes a very nice gravy, and even with the beer portion of it. And what I always do is I my family typically cleans a good portion of the meat off the bird. I'll generally follow the next meal with making soup out of it, and I'll retain that liquid to use as sort of a starting flavoring base for that soup.
Okay, there you go. That's a good idea.
Every time I do a chicken, I follow it up the next day with the soup. You know.
and then what do you do with the soup? Then you just imbibe the soup.
And then eat it. Yeah.
Then you eat it. You probably drink it, huh?
Oh, yeah. One of the things, Peter, that you know, we encourage people to try is using chicken broth in the base. You know, chicken broth will not impart that much of the, you know, you won't get the beer flavor from it, but if you want to retain that liquid, and I might add, this is the only product that's out on the market that retains the liquid from the cooking bird, and every good chef knows that that's where the flavor is when you want to make retained liquid.
Right.
If you were to use chicken broth, that can be used to steam your vegetables, do your mashed potatoes with, and certainly makes a wonderful base for your soup.
Good stuff. How about a website?
Website, guys?
Well, we've got two websites. We have the website with the Poultry Pal, which is
beercanchicken.com.
Okay.
And then the website for the cookbook is redowlpublications.com.
Well,
want
guys,
to do those again? Do you want to do those?
No, we'll
again?
We'll put those on the website.
We'll put it on.
In fact, I think that Zen and the Art of Cooking Beer Can Chicken's already on OTM bookshelf. So if anybody listens, if you're interested, all you have to do is go there to get it.
One thing I'd like to comment on that's a little bit different. This thing has been a very interesting adventure. I formed Red Owl Publications for the purpose of publishing the book and you know, working directly with Tom, we kind of formed a joint marketing partner, and his company does the Poultry Pal, my company does the cookbook, and working together, we've basically had quite a synergistic marketing effort that has been valuable to both of our efforts in sort of promoting. So, and in a sense, the sum is far greater than the whole of the individuals, which is an exciting thing, and it's a different twist, I think, a little bit to conventional marketing strategies. So we're looking to we're going to probably write another book coming up here about
marketing strategies
for, you know, blue collar marketing strategies. Yeah. I guess.
Well,
yeah.
You're having a good time, and
yeah.
That's
oh, absolutely.
Great. Thanks for sharing that with us. Too.
Yeah, I mean, listeners. You just got to get one of these. I mean, it's not. This is not beer can chicken for yuppies. This is just an excellent product that produces the juiciest chicken you've ever had in your whole life, and makes it easy as well. Get with the Zen, get a beer can chicken cooker, and away you go. And gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a delight to talk to you.
Thank you. I enjoyed it too.
Well, Peter and Ann, thank you so much. We look forward to talking with you sometime in the future.
Bye, guys.
I'd like to just point out that I have another product in development that is for the grilling. It'll be for the gas grill and charcoal grills.
Well, you'll have to be sure to make sure that we get a sample to try out, and then we'll have you back on the program.
Absolutely.
Have a great day, guys.
Thanks, guys.
Take care now.
Bye.
Bye.
And now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig.
Isn't that remarkable? They're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig.
Don't know what you're talking about.
I'm just trying to put you off your stride, dear.
I see. Well, at any rate, let's move right along here. We have a spiritual connection between the beer can chicken and the people who want to export it to Australia, which has a fine tradition of outdoor grilling.
And we're in northern New South Wales in the small community of Byron Bay. We were visiting with Martin Brook of Brook Farm, but he wanted to have the manager of his macadamia nut plantation have the opportunity to talk. So we actually chatted with Peter instead of chatting with Martin, which we've done before.
Yes.
So here's the man who
the picture is that we explain we're in a rainforest growing
growing macadamia nuts, and there's a wonderful picture.
It had just rained, and after all that drought, it had just poured down rain, so that we were almost trapped in the mud with the vehicle, and also I kept dodging mosquitoes. Yeah. Well, with that setting, go ahead.
There you go. It rained for 20-some days in a row, but it didn't rain the day we were there. In fact, it was a beautiful day. If you're fascinated with how they managed to harvest macadamia nuts, you can go to the website and look at a picture of the wonderful machine that they invented or reinvented in order to do this, because you can't pick the macadamia nuts off the tree. You have to wait till they fall off. So that introduces a whole lot of new challenges to be able to pick these nuts at a reasonable cost, and Martin and Pete and co managed to solve this. So it's a rather fascinating little machine. They also have a tractor they called a Ferrari, which Anne took a look at, and I think we took a picture of that as well, and it's not the least little bike like any other Ferrari you've ever seen. But Brook Farm is quite an enterprise. I'm sure you'll be interested to hear more about how they go about this process.
It's not every day, listeners to On the Menu Radio, that you get a chance to interview the manager of a macadamia nut farm. But you also know that your intrepid hosts, Anne and Peter, do get into the nicest places. And we're near Byron Bay in northern New South Wales. And I'm talking to Pete Barton, who is the farm manager of Brook Farm. Peter, good morning.
Good morning, Peter.
Tell us about this magical process that you've developed here for growing macadamias in what seems to us like a special way, as you've just explained it to us.
Well, here at Brook Farm, we do things a little bit different than the average macadamia farm. With our rainforest and eucalypt forests and riparian wet zones, we're finding if we work with nature and rather than against it, we get a lot better results and produce a more high-quality product. We use integrated pest management on the farm here, and that's basically working with nature. So if we have an insect that's being a problem, we research, we put out a predator to that insect, and by using natural biological means like that, we can control that pest.
Now, so these little wasps, tell us how big they are, and you put some of these little wasps on every single tree.
Well, these little wasps are trigogramma wasps, and they're 0.5 of a millimetre big. You really have to look to see where they are, but when you go to the post office and you pick them up from where they come from, Queensland, and you say you've got 5,000 wasps in this little envelope, everyone looks at you strangely at the post office.
I'll just bet they do. Now, give us a scale of the entire operation. How many acres, how many trees, and how many finished nuts you come up with?
We're 4,500 macadamia trees, and to put the whole farm in perspective, we've got close to 40,000 rainforest trees and another 20,000 eucalypt trees. We produce between 60 to 70 tonne of macadamia each per season, and that's on an average.
And those nuts go into making a variety of different products, right?
All the nuts we produce on this farm go into our high-quality products up at the factory.
Yeah, so this is an integrated operation. It's called Brook Farm, and Martin Brook, who's standing over in the background there, staying out of Pete's way because it's his turn in the limelight, actually invented this whole operation. How many years ago was it, Pete?
Brook Farm's basically been 19, 20 years in the making, and so it hasn't been an overnight success story as it is now. But to get where we are and naturally farm the way we're doing things, environmentally sensitive, it's really been 19 years in the making.
Now, you came from a traditional, conventional farm background, and you've been transformed into this natural farmer. Describe how that happened and why this is so much better.
Well, I've lived locally around the area most of my life and been involved in macadamia farming, managing a lot of larger farms over the years. And it got to the stage where I could just see that the macadamia industry just had to change their ways. You know, the use of chemicals you really didn't have to use chemicals, the indiscriminate use of rat poison just because you had a few rats and you couldn't be bothered building the ecosystem to naturally control them. And, you know, spraying weeds and having the place look like a golf course or a bowling green. And you don't see many beautiful wildlife running around on a bowling green. It's a sterile environment, and that's what macadamia farmers were encouraging. So to come here with our green principles and everything else, it's really reinvigorated me in the macadamia industry.
And not only that, you got koalas on the property too, I understand. So you have a pair, and maybe Martin, will you get some more, do you think? Martin's nodding. He's thinking that it's a wonderful environment for them, and it just speaks to the way that nature can come back. And then you've got dams all over the place with another creature, Martin.
Yeah, we've actually got duck-billed platypus in the dams. The really exciting thing, it's taken 19 years for the koalas to... We started with a lone male, and our neighbour said, oh, I can't sleep at night because koalas really make the most extraordinary loud noise. And then we discovered, in fact, that a female had moved in. So we're going to have a family of koalas in the eucalypt forest, which is so exciting for all of us. But we've got wallaby, we've got quite a lot of snakes. Some of them dangerous. You've got to be a bit careful. But these snakes play such an important role in keeping the nasty things like rats and mice down. So we like the snakes, but you've got to be careful of some of them.
Well, listeners, you're going to be able to look on the website to see some pictures of this glorious spot. that we just drove around because it's too muddy to walk. And besides, I'm scared of all the mosquitoes. So do look at that. I'm going to put those up by the time you hear this, they'll probably be there. Let's just quickly go over the range of products that Brook Farms puts out. Who'd like to do that, Pete or Martin?
Okay. Well, I guess what we're most famous for, well known for, is our beautiful macadamia mueslis. And these are like a granola, but I guess they're a little more complicated. And they've got about 17 ingredients. We do a toasted, we do a natural, a raw one, and then we do this fantastic gluten-free one. And the thing with all our products, and then we do a range of wonderful first cold press macadamia oils, healthiest nut oil in the world, 84% monounsaturated. You can cook it at very high temperatures. Smoke point of this oil is 420 degrees, about 420 degrees Fahrenheit. It doesn't lose any of its wonderful health benefits. And then we do a range of nuts. But our thing really is getting back to the slow food way. What do I mean by that? The traditional ways of making food. No additives, no preservatives. Going back to those methods where, in fact, you do produce beautiful tasting food. Food in the old-fashioned ways.
Well, listeners, we'll have to tell you the story later about the Ferrari and the nut picker, but there'll be pictures of those on the website too. Pete, thanks so much for your hospitality and for your explanation of what's going on.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. We enjoy showing the place off any time.
We actually made our way to northern New South Wales to Byron Bay by flying from Sydney to Brisbane, the capital of Queensland and a great boom town in its own right, with primary industry, mostly coal, being mined and sent to China under long-term contract. It's a really busy place, lots and lots going on, and what used to be a sleepy city has now become a very dynamic one.
How many people was it they said moved in every day or something?
I think it was 1,500 people every day moving from the rest of Australia, or from the rest of the world for that matter, I suppose, and settling in Queensland. And you can tell it from the roads, which are absolutely packed with vehicles. So we ran into traffic jams almost everywhere we went. And in a city like that, you want to find a place that's a little out of the way, that's a little quiet. And fortunately, through some people that we got to know, we found a hotel called the Royal on the Park. In fact, I think it was Martin Brook from Brook Farm who recommended it to us. And it sits on a reasonably quiet street on the edge of town, right across the street from the botanical gardens, in a very charming spot. And we had a chance to talk to the general manager of this establishment about why it's been able to maintain this relative calm in the midst of all this chaos.
Listeners, by now you know that on the menus in Brisbane, the capital of Queensland, and Brisbane is booming. Brisbane is a bustling city with enormous economic vitality, thousands of people on the streets, shopping, working, and there's an island of calm on the edge of the city called the Botanical Gardens. And right across the street from the Botanical Gardens, a charming hotel called the Royal on the Park. We had the opportunity to stay here, and I had the chance to catch up with the general manager, Mark Evans, who says he's the longest-serving general manager of any hotel in Brisbane, and he runs a property that's really quite unique. Mark, tell us about the Royal on the Park.
Yes, thank you. Royal on the Park was built in 1968, and it's probably one of the oldest hotels in Brisbane. It's got a unique history, seen many superstars pass through the doors. Elton John used to love staying here. In fact, that piano behind you, he played that quite a few times. And so it's still actually his favourite hotel. But we've had many people through the doors, many famous people. And we've got a reputation that people love coming to the Royal on the Park because it is nice and quiet. It's just out of the city, but it's only a five-minute walk to the centre of the city. And it's got a lovely feel to it. People just like the atmosphere. And I think with quite a few years on its being built here, it's got a personality of its own. We've taken that to an extra level. My staff now concentrate on just service. Service is the main feature of the hotel. So everyone that comes through the door is our friend, and the staff warm to those clients and guests every day. And that's what keeps people coming back.
No, Angela was most helpful. We called her yesterday. We were driving down the road to Byron Bay, and we called and said, Angela, you have to help us. We need to catch up with some more Brisbane restaurants, but we don't have the telephone numbers. So she got them all, some more recommendations, and called us right back. that kind of personal service has to be, you know, one, just one example, it's a hallmark of the hotel. But you've got something else happening that's kind of exciting here in your restaurant. Tell us about that.
Yes, I've been associated with the Australian Culinary Federation for around about 12 years. That's a worldwide organisation, and it's part of the breeding of chefs throughout Australia. And what the organisation does is develop the culture of cuisine and apprentice chefs and nurture the industry. And I, as I said, I've always been very keen to be a sponsor for the Australian Culinary Federation. Part of that is also the Olympic team that travels to Germany once every year. The Olympic team actually stay at this hotel as it's their preferred hotel. During my association with the Australian Culinary Federation, I've met quite a few of the best chefs in Australia and developed close relationships with these people. And luckily, I've got the ex-captain of the Australian Culinary Federation joining the hotel. He is, his name is Gary Farrell, and arguably probably the best chef in Australia. There is testimony to this, is there's a award called the Black Hat, and it's awarded to chefs that have gone beyond the call of duty for the industry. And Gary was the youngest receiver of this award at the age of 36. There's only six in Australia given out thus far. So his experience in the industry, his knowledge of the Australian culinary scene will no doubt put Royal in the Park up there with the best product, best cuisine, best food for banquets in Brisbane.
Well, you must be sure to send us a copy of his menu once he gets it on the ground. He's going to be starting how soon?
Well, Gary's actually started last week. He's at the moment, he's judging away. He's up in Darwin today. So Gary does still quite a bit of judging throughout Australia.
Okay, well, let's get the essentials included in the interview, like a website, an address for the hotel. It's how we found the Royal on the Park to begin with, once we got a recommendation from Martin Brook at Brook Farm. And listeners, this is absolutely the place to be, because it is just exactly as convenient as Mark said it was. I've been wandering the streets of Brisbane from here, and in just a few minutes you can be on a wonderful pedestrian mall if you like to shop. You can see some of the wonderful old buildings that still remain here in the center of the city. The longest walk that I didn't make was all the way to Anzac Square, right in the center of town, but if I had more time, I'd certainly do that. So, Mark, thank you so much for your welcome here at the hotel. A last thought for our guests, together with the website information, if you would, please.
Just one thing to the Royal in the Park, won best hotel in Queensland for 4.5-star hotel last year, which is quite a big accolade for the property. We've got a new website starting probably in 4 weeks, but this website will still get you through to the current one. It's www.royalonthepark.com.au.
Yeah, listeners, remember that AU. And it's not .co like in the UK. It's .com, C-O-M, .au, the Royal on the Park. Do stay here. Once again, Mark, thank you so much for talking to us and for the welcome at your hotel.
And it's now time again to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Remember that you can email us at any time on the menu at onthemenuradio.com. And now we're going to have an interesting conversation with a man who is regarded as the father of modern cuisine in Brisbane. Do you want to pick it up from there, Rabbit?
It's really interesting. We came tearing up the highway into Brisbane in rush hour traffic, and in the midst of doing that, we've finally managed to get in touch with Philip Johnson, whose restaurant's called Echo. Just a kind of there was a reason for that name. We talked to him, and it turns out that it's ECCO, but then there's an apostrophe in there. We never understood how it got there, and he couldn't either. But it was wonderful to have a chance to catch up with someone that we'd heard so much about, and we hadn't been able to reach him before. So it was a real pleasure, and it turns out that a generation of possibly two generations of Brisbane restaurateurs say, if Philip Johnson hadn't done this, we wouldn't be where we are today. So he's certainly someone that shouldn't be missed. And if you're interested in the Queensland dining scene, this is where it all began.
And we are still in Brisbane having a good time. The restaurant that we're checking out right now is called Echo, although it's spelled E apostrophe C-C-O. And we're talking to the chef owner, Philip Johnson, who is not the architect. The architect is no longer alive. And this man certainly is. And he's a very vibrant force in the Australian scene altogether, in the dining scene. And, well, first let me just say, hello, Philip.
Hi.
How are you? You were originally actually not from here. You're a New Zealander?
Yeah, I'm from Christchurch in the South Island, New Zealand, but I've lived in Brisbane close to 30 years. I'm pretty much, it's home to me.
Well, the man is an icon in the restaurant industry all over Australia. And I said to him jokingly, how many people have you had going through your kitchen? Because every time we run into a chef, they said, oh, well, we worked with or he worked with or she worked with Phil Johnson. You are a huge mentor, are you not?
I think the answer to that really is I've always taken the philosophy of surrounding yourself with the right people. And if you do that, eventually some of them will, you know, go on and do their own thing. And I mean, I always support that. That's rewarding. But in the time they're here, they actually make my business very strong. So, you know, I have no trouble employing people of substantial skills because they can only enhance your own business.
And you're very sure of yourself anyhow. You're not nervous about other people usurping your limelight.
No, not really. I mean, I've been in this industry 20 years. Initially, you're very sort of, possessive of your recipes and bits and bobs, but eventually, and I've had two restaurants now, we've published a number of books, so it's all out on the forum anyway, so there's no real secrets. It's just, I think the point of difference is that if we do it better, we'll always be the benchmark for that particular dish. So it's, you know, I don't live in fear of someone sort of nicking an idea. It's, you know, I mean, we sort of take the view that our next menu, our next work is our best work. So what we do or what we publish is probably yesterday's work anyway. So it's not of great concern to me.
Now your cookbooks are practically revered, like, probably because you're giving away all your secrets in them. What is your website? And your cookbooks are probably available for purchase on that website.
Our website's just www.ecobistro.com. So it's ECCOBISTRO, all one word, .com. And we've had that for about 8 or 9 years, and it's been a great tool for us, mainly with the, you know, we used to get a lot of people asking us to fax them menus and things like that. It's a lot easier if you can just, they can go to the website. But we sell books and, you know, things, our olive oil and things on that website. So it's a great tool for us, and most of the information about the restaurant or myself is there.
Talk to us a little bit about the restaurant. It's very sleek and sophisticated. And your style of cooking?
I suppose when we got into Echo, we had a vision that it would have a format that the staff would have butcher's aprons, the tables would have no tablecloths. It was sort of every lesson I'd learned in my first restaurant, I sort of put into this restaurant, and we've been here 12 years and we haven't really changed the focus. And that's the thing I often see in restaurants and how they lose focus is they set out to do one thing and they end up doing another. And I think whatever we set out to do, we're still doing, and we're doing it 12 years later, and that's what people respect you for. They respect you for consistency and delivering the same product time and time again. That's what gives you a reputation, not sort of doing one thing one week, then another thing the next. So it's about consistency.
You know, I always joke with people about consistency, even if the restaurant is only mediocre. If it's what you know that they're consistently mediocre, you know what to expect. Let's talk a little bit about your Mod Oz, modern Australian, is your style of cuisine. To give us some explanation, could you just, I have this menu I'm staring at, could you just describe some of the dishes, your signature dishes?
I mean, really from day one, 12 years, we've only had one dish that stayed on, and it's our field mushrooms with olive toast, rocket parmesan, truffle oil and lemon. And it's a very simplistic dish. It's really a piece of sourdough with some olive tapenade, some field mushrooms that have been roasted, some parmesan, a little bit of truffle oil, some rocket, a little bit of balsamic. There's really essentially something you could do at home, but where people, and that is a dish that I think has been copied a lot.
I think I had it for lunch.
But where they miss out is that they use a rubber, you know, like a not a great piece of toast or bread. The mushrooms aren't great. The parmesan is not the real deal. The rocket's substandard. And by the time, you know, you just get this, as well as you can get a layering of quality, you can get a layering of inferior quality. So if everything's not adhered to, you don't end up with the result. I mean, I suppose a lot of the other influences on the menu, it comes with who you surround yourself at the time. I remember once someone saying to me, oh, I see that you're doing, you know, you've sort of taken on a sort of Asian, sort of Indian influence because we had some sort of curry on. And I said, no, we haven't. But it at the time, it could have been the chef that wants to do that. And we're pretty happy to run with that. Like they always run it past me. But at the moment we've got a Matthias, he's a Swedish chap. He's been with me for a number of years. And I let him sort of run with the ideas too, because I mean, that's how you really progress a business, is using all your resources. And if you employ good people, they are your resources. So within that sort of fairly loose framework of modern Australian, which really draws from Asian and sort of like a modern European take. It's not that traditional, but it's not really was once. It's not that sort of Pacific Rim cuisine, which I think was just a bit too way out. But in some ways, Australia doesn't really have the heritage of perhaps what the French and Italian have. But in other ways, there's some of the best chefs in the world here because they're very free to do what they want. They don't feel as if they have to attain a Michelin star, or if they don't do a perfect, you know, whatever, they'll be judged differently. But here, people are pretty free to have a go. Again, that can be dangerous because you get people who work without a net and they make a big mistake. But on the whole, it's pretty good.
What about this dish just below? You said the gnocchi.
Yeah, I think there's just so much bad gnocchi in the world that a good one is to be revered. And we've just actually employed a chef. He's not the one that always makes it. We've employed a young guy that worked a year at Per Se. So one of his jobs there was the gnocchi. So, but I think when he came here, a gnocchi was pretty good anyway. And that's just with some Serrano ham, which is just fresh, torn over the top of the sautéed gnocchi, with some little clams that we open up with a little tomato sauce and some manchego cheese and a little sherry vinaigrette. So it's a really sort of light dish, and it's just all the flavours, what you see is what you get, which I guess is what our food is. It's very honest. It's just a lot of work's put into the preparation and the sourcing of goods, but when it's put on the plate, it's really pretty simplistic. We just, you know.
Well, I think that's really where everything that's really good is heading, is the more simpler, simpler and simpler. Now, we were talking, and you travel a lot. You just got back from, I guess, November. You were in the States. Talk to us a little bit about all these restaurants you went to. I mean, this is part of how you just keep excited, right?
Yeah, I mean, we had 14 meals, and I didn't really have a bad one. I mean, that's great in any country. And we were in San Francisco.
Where did you go?
Yeah, Chez Panisse, which was what I'd always wanted to do, and it was as good as I'd ever thought it would be. We also ate at a Spanish tapas place that we just really got recommended by someone. The name eludes me, but that was amazing. Then
Piperad?
It wasn't that one, but it's fairly new. I forget the name. But then we're in the Napa, and we had an amazing meal at French Laundry, which you'd expect to. But I also love Bouchon, which is his, Thomas's bistro there.
I like the Bouchon cookbook better than the other.
Yeah. I think it's more achievable, but it's...
Exactly. Have you ever made anything out of the French Laundry cookbook? Not I.
We haven't. It works, which is good. But then we're in Chicago, which I love as a city, and we ate at Avoc and Blackbird. I've eaten at Charlie Trotter's before. I didn't this time. I think it was MK's we ate at, which was quite good. And Alinea, which was another stunning meal. I mean, it was the molecular cooking, and it's perhaps not for everyone, but it was done at a level that I think, you know, perhaps in the first few courses you could dismiss it as whatever, or you could embrace it. And if you embraced it, I think you got taken on quite a special journey.
And then of course, the place is spectacular, is it not? Yeah. And you were in Manhattan?
Yep, absolutely. We stayed at the Mercer, so we ate close there at, we ate at Baltazar, Peasant, Mirandi, I think.
Did you like Mirandi? We haven't gone there.
Yeah, Miranda was good. Yeah. And Prune, I think it is, was great.
Oh, Gabrielle, she's fabulous.
Yeah. So all in all, it was a fantastic trip. But, I mean, at the end of the day, you sort of, I came back and I was happy with what I'm doing because, you know, food worldwide, you know, it doesn't matter what it costs or where it is, it's an experience, and that's what we try to achieve at our restaurant is if the food's good, the staff are nice, the ambience right. It's about having a great experience. It's not only about having great food. Great food's a big component, but it's not the only component.
Peter has a question.
But we've had a number of people tell us that one of the things that's really good about the restaurant business here is the superb range of fresh ingredients. It's almost like it's not fair. What's in your larder? It's like California compared to the rest of the United States. What they have in their larder is not fair. What do you think about that?
Yeah, look, it's a mixed one. I mean, you'll get European and English chefs that come out here and they hanker for foie gras and truffles, which we don't really get here. You know, we get them in very small quantities in Tasmania. But perhaps you should, and that's what has happened, is you should embrace what we do well here, whether that be ocean trout or some rabbits out of New South Wales. You know, we should embrace what you've got here because it's like trying to use a tomato out of season. I mean, sometimes, you know, I don't think you have to go totally seasonal, but sometimes things are better at certain times of the years and people should respect that. And if you really want, you know, foie gras in Australia has to be pasteurised. So if you really want something cooked, well then, you know, it comes out of a tin. It's not the same as eating it in France. So perhaps it's not the be all and end all and you can go down a different route. But it's, you know, we also embrace a lot, bit of a little, you know, like a market gardener will bring us in food and show us something. We will take it just for the fact of, as long as it's great, which it usually is, just to support that person. Because if you don't, if you say it's too dear and you don't want it and that, well, then these people never are encouraged to pursue that avenue. So there's, I mean, the big producers can always give you the food, but at the end of the day, you're looking for that point of difference, and often that's, you know, a bit of organic veg or something that, you know, I mean, that was sort of plain to see it, Chez Panisse. I mean, the food looked like it had just been put on the plate, but when you put it in your mouth, it was just a different experience. It was just so good that, you know, it is all about produce.
Well, you were so thoughtful in all these questions I'm asking you. We could go on and on, of course. Is there one other thought? Have we not touched on something that you would like to note about your experiences in the kitchen and restaurant business and traveling?
Oh, look, I think I'm sort of pleased that I have been involved in an industry which is so vibrant and it allows you to do many things. When I was younger, I was able to travel and I worked in England and things like that. So it has that aspect that when you're young, you can travel. But then when you decide to settle down, it can be a great industry too. But I do think a lot of people think that, you know, they want to be an overnight success and they really have to. This industry takes years and people will vote with their feet, but it actually takes time and you can't expect, you know, to be full, you know, just when you swing open the doors. The fact that you spend $1 million on a fit-out's got nothing to do with it. You've got to prove to them that you've got a great product. And just a fit-out is not a great product. A fit-out is a fit-out. So, I do think people take a short-term view, and I think that it's a long-term, it's a thing you've really got to work towards, yeah.
Well, you practice what you preach, and you don't preach after you discuss gently. And I've enjoyed talking to you, and thank you for taking the time.
Thank you. I hope you enjoy the rest of your stay.
And listeners, there's lots more to come. So stay with us and we'll see you on the other side of the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
We really weren't sure what to expect about the restaurant scene in Brisbane.
So much so that we forgot to say welcome back, listeners. You're with On the Menu Radio once more.
I don't think we have to say that all the time.
Oh, we don't have to say that. Okay, we're a bit too pre-programmed, huh?
I don't think anybody wants to hear it anymore. I do think, however, they're going to want to hear these two great hot restaurants that we discovered. We'll run them both together, the both interviews. The first one is...
There are actually two interviews, one with the chef and one with one of the owners at a restaurant called Urbane, which we consider a real find. A real find.
We loved it. And
we got the lead on this from the assistant manager at the China Doll in Sydney. We said, where should we go eat in Brisbane? And he didn't let us down. So we called Urbane. I can't even remember if we called them. We might just walked in and said, we're here and we're on the menu and we'd like to have dinner, but we'd like to talk to you first. And that was fun. And then on another evening, we didn't actually dine at a restaurant called Two. That's an imaginative name. It's Roman numeral 2 on the sign, and it's TWO in the name. And I called there and I said, we really would like to talk to you. And the person who answered the phone said, well, that'll be all right. Just come on over at such and such a time. He said, I have a big party going on, but that'll be okay. What you will find is a reasonable amount of background noise, and we had to talk fairly loud. But it turned out the gentleman who answered the phone was the owner, and it was very interesting to chat with him. And it was also very exciting because he was only about 200 yards up the street from the Royal on the park. So I had a very short walk down, a very short walk back. So first up is Urbane, and then two.
We also are in a restaurant called Urbane, talking to the head chef, who is Kim Machen. Hello, Kim.
Hello, how are you today?
Well, Kim is going to tell us all about what we're going to eat at Urbane, and also, which is, by the way, one of my most favorite words. I always like to use that. It's a great name for a restaurant. You're going to tell us what to expect with the restaurant, your kitchen here. You are the head chef. And also, we're going to ask you a little bit about the city we know nothing about is Brisbane. First of all, tell us about Urbane. How long has it been around, and what kind of food do you serve?
Urbane's been around now for about 7 years. I've been a part of Urbane now for about five. Since I've been at Urbane, it's slowly grown with Brisbane. So coming from Adelaide at a restaurant called The Grange, and from Tetsu's in Sydney, I think, and then moving to Brisbane, it was moving quite slowly, but in 5 years it's generated and grown very, very quickly.
You were at Tetsuya's?
Yes.
We could not get a reservation. The last time we were able to get into the place was the old place. Do you remember that?
That's where I worked. I was in Sydney not long ago, and I was speaking to Tetsuya at Restaurant 07, and I couldn't even get a seat in there either.
We had everybody working on it. And at the very last minute, they said they could not squeeze us in.
Yeah, no, it's quite different. But it's one of the best restaurants of Australia and rated in the world. So with that, it is quite hard to get into the restaurant.
Well, now, with that background, what kind of food do you cook here?
Growing up at the start of my apprenticeship, for the first 7 years, I was doing a lot of European food. My head chef was Austrian, so a lot of the heavy European food.
Okay, let's explain to listeners. You were Thai-born, or Thailand-born, you are Thai, raised by English parents in South Australia. Now, that's a combination, and they worked at Tetsuya. I'm expecting a very cosmopolitan meal here. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's very different. I actually never knew how to cook Asian food for a long time, and everyone would always ask me, can you cook Thai food? Can you cook Thai food, Kim? And I said, no, I can't. I've spent a lot of my time doing European food. So after my apprenticeship, the first place I headed down was Sydney to work with David Thompson at Darley Street Thai. And as much as I love the food, coming from a heavily influenced background of European food, it just wasn't for me. And I was only there for maybe 3 months before I wanted to move back into the European style food.
So you're doing European style here, but you must have influences from this wonderful, wonderful cuisine, Thai cuisine.
I moved on when I was in Melbourne. I worked at a place called Flower Drum.
That got best restaurant in Australia 1 year when we were here.
Yes, that also got best restaurant, the Flower Drum. And I just wanted to work with all these type of Asian food. And a lot of my friends were Chinese, and I just wanted to go and experience the Chinese kitchen, which was very hard because I didn't speak Chinese. So communication was hard, but we managed through it.
You know, you've been all these places. You can't have been all... You're so young.
I'm actually 31.
That's young.
I started my apprenticeship when I was 15, and I finished... It was 5 years I spent as an apprentice. Because I also did my pastry apprenticeship at the same time.
Well, we still haven't talked. Do you have a few dishes that you're thinking we're going to be eating tonight?
Hopefully, we'll give you some of a tasting menu. Our tasting menu is an 8-course menu, and it derives from our a la carte menu. And unfortunately, tonight is not one of the nights. We have a prestige menu where we have a 14-course degustation dinner. And we just run that on Fridays and Saturdays at the moment.
Aside from this wonderful restaurant, what's going on? Brisbane is exploding in terms of being busy and growing in population. What's happening with the restaurant scene here? And tell us some specifics about restaurants that our listeners might want to look up.
Oh, with everyone moving up from down south, I think it was 2,000 people a week, they say, are moving to Brisbane or Queensland, which is amazing. So it is growing rapidly. And I think they say in 2010 will be as big as Melbourne, which is pretty scary.
I can't picture that.
When I first moved up 6 years ago, driving to work was easy, and now it's busy. It's like peak hour traffic. Like, I couldn't believe it. It's like Sydney. It can get like Sydney traffic sometimes. An hour to move less than 2 kilometres. It's amazing.
So, but what's happening with restaurants? As you know, they drive everything, or everything drives restaurants.
I think in the time that I've been here, the food scene has grown amazingly, absolutely amazing. We have people are just so much more willing to open up and eat different food now, which is excellent.
What kind of food are they eating? What are the hot restaurants?
I think people now are willing to eat anything that we would serve up, which is excellent. You can try stuff off. The molecular food people are willing to try. It's not always on people's taste buds, and not everyone likes it, but it's very different, and I think that's coming.
Well, who's doing molecular?
There's not too many restaurants doing it up here at the moment. I know there's a lot of restaurants in Sydney and Melbourne that are doing it, which is excellent, and these restaurants are amazing. Raymond Capaldi is an amazing chef to watch and learn from.
And, who's that again?
Raymond Capaldi.
Where?
In Phoenix, in Melbourne, and the menu and the food is just on another level. It's mind-blowing. So next time anyone goes to Melbourne, they try that for a different meal. It's not what everyone likes, but to look at that food and just to experience it once is absolutely amazing.
Yeah, I mean, we've eaten at El Bulli. Yeah. In fact, Doc, we did all this. Yeah. You haven't mentioned specifics. Urbane is on the top of our list, obviously. Where else do people eat in Brisbane?
In Brisbane, Isis is another restaurant people love to eat at. Brisbane people love eating at Isis. It always gets spoken about. Jason Pepper is an excellent chef and a good friend. Gianni's is also an excellent restaurant to go to with Javier. Manx with Paul is also on the top of the cards for a lot of people. And you've got the cheaper restaurants that are not bad. You've got the legendary Thierry from Montrachet and Philip Johnson from Echo. They're icons, and David Pugh from Restaurant 2. They're icons of Brisbane, with Russell Armstrong at Armstrong's at Seasalt. The amazing restaurants, all of them.
Well, they were actually all on our list, so I guess we're on the same page with all these. Well, we're looking forward to seeing what you're serving tonight. Yeah, let's give our listeners your website.
Our website is just being developed now, so they won't be able to find too much in the next few weeks. So we're just having the photo shoots now. I think it'll be under Urbane. I've just got to speak to the boss. I don't know if they've...
Okay, well, we can report back on that. I'm anxious to taste your food. Are you going to serve us good stuff?
Of course I'm going to serve you good stuff.
Kim, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you very much for having me.
We're now talking, actually, to one of the owners of Urbane. We felt that he should have a chance to say something, because he has a very interesting background. It's Drew Patton, and he is a first-generation Australian, and he has an Italian background. And tell us why. You have so many complications. Very interesting person. Tell us what else is about you that's unusual.
Just my lifestyle, the way I live my life, the way I do things. Very eccentric.
But it's very Australian.
I just enjoy life. I've studied. I've had a couple of different careers already. I'm only in my early 30s.
Tell me what career.
I was a snowboard bum. I lived in Canada for 12 months in BC, then came back and was quite serious about my studies and got back, and then did a Master's of Business Administration, majoring in Information System Management and E-Commerce, and worked
Dull.
Yeah, very dull. So saw the light and got out of that and ended up back in hospitality because it was my job while I was at university.
Now, and you were the one who has the history of hospitality. No. Okay. Then why did you want to leave all this wonderful stuff that your academic studies and go into hospitality? And how did you get involved with owning a restaurant?
Well, as I said, it was my vocational job while I was at university, and I used to work at a hotel in Byron Bay called Reyes and Wadigos, which was my summer job while I was doing my master's, and fell in love with hospitality there. And it was when I quit my job in Sydney and I moved back to Byron after working in my chosen profession as a professional after fulfilling my master's degree. I worked at Reyes and Wadigos, and I was staying there and living with the owner, and he used to own this restaurant, and he said, he was talking to his lawyer, and I said, I'll do it.
What would you say, people thinking of visiting Brisbane, what's so wonderful that it offers?
Brisbane offers an open aspect to beaches. I mean, we're a summer environment. I mean, we've got the north coast of Queensland, which is Sunshine Beach, from Maroochydore up to Sunshine Beach, which is absolutely beautiful. And then we've also got the northern beaches of New South Wales, from Byron up to the Tweed, and then from the Tweed through to the Gold Coast. So there's a wonderful range of beautiful white beaches there.
Do you surf?
I'd love to surf more.
I see. I mean, it really is a whole thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a lifestyle. And living in Brisbane, it's an hour and a half drive to Sunshine Beach, or to the northern beaches of Brisbane, and it's 45 minutes to the Gold Coast. So it's fantastic. You jump, leave your board on the car Saturday night, and after service, jump in the car and head for the coast.
Tell our listeners one reason why they should come to Urbane.
For the wonderful food that Kim does, but also the very personal and unobtrusive service.
Also, he's absolutely delightful and charming, so you'll feel very comfortable here. Thanks.
Thank you very much, and I look forward to seeing you at Urbane.
By now, listeners, you know that On the Menu is in Brisbane. And On the Menu is in Brisbane at a restaurant called Two. There is no one. Talking to the chef founder, David Pugh. And I'm going to ask him first about the Brisbane dining scene that wasn't and now is. And then go on to talk about his take on cooking and his restaurant here in Brisbane. David, first of all, welcome to On the Menu.
It's a privilege to be on the menu. I'm looking forward to a conversation.
Okay, so go. You opened this restaurant in 1999. Before that, you did something else, but something's happened with the dining scene in Brisbane that didn't exist before.
We really have progressed in Brisbane. We're Australia's third largest city, and I think we're the second biggest growing city in the might be the world, but definitely the southern hemisphere. We are a go-to place, and a lot of companies are setting up here, and that reflects extremely well on our tourism scene, extremely well on our dining out scene, the caliber of people that are coming to Brisbane to settle, to set up their businesses, and to enjoy the lifestyle, the beautiful climate that we have, and not only that, the fantastic produce that we have just makes it so easy some days to be a chef, that you're wondering what should I put on the menu, because it's there in abundance. It's the riches are just so indescribable. The seafood we have really is just second to none. We have some beautiful lamb, and everything is accessible in Australia. It's a big continent, but it's readily accessible and can be here within 24-hour period. So we live in that sort of day and age where, you know, we think local and we work Australia-wide if necessary. Also supporting Queensland as a state, as a growing state, with the produce that is available within the bounds of our climate. You know, we have some absolutely beautiful beef, which is grown in Queensland. We have some magnificent Wagyu, which is actually exported live to Japan, grown and then processed in Japan. And that sort of thing doesn't come about through just through pure accident. That comes about through sheer hard Australian work. And the work ethic here is a very strong one. Our primary producers as I say, they make my job so easy. It's just a fantastic thing. You know, you get out of bed and you think, well, what am I going to have on the menu today? Most of the menu was predetermined, but when it comes to seafood, when it comes to some special, you know, meat products, that we really do get spoiled for choice.
Now, funny thing, I haven't seen barramundi on a menu yet in Queensland.
We're having a few problems at the moment. We've just had a few storms and cyclones up the north end of Queensland, and barramundi is not a cyclone-proof fish. It's one of those ones where it's grown and it grows in rivers. They do farm it, and they farm it in rivers. It's nice clean product. It's probably the cousin of what they call the Nile perch. Very similar sort of fish, but this one is native to Australia. But you will see it in abundance when you get to some of the coastal towns in the north, from Brisbane northwards. It's just about on every single menu. But this time of the year, we're having a really bad run. So you'll probably see things like local whiting, sand whiting. You might see some local snapper, some coral trout. One of my favourites is a pearl perch. You know, and the seafood here, it's different. It has a slight residual sweetness about it. It's not that salty tang which you get in the colder waters. We are, after all, a tropical and subtropical climate here in Queensland, particularly in Brisbane. So a lot of our seafood has that sort of sweetness about it. And some of the mud crabs that we get here, which are exported, if you think picking beautiful corn and eating corn like straight out of the garden, then think along the lines of a mud crab for sweetness, and the two marry extremely well together. We do partner them from time to time.
Now, is that a Moreton Bay bug, or is a Moreton Bay bug something different?
Moreton Bay bug is something different. They come by the name of bug because they look like something that's ugly, but they have a beautiful flesh. It's like a lobster, but a sweet flesh. It has a prehistoric looking head. You might be known to be calling them slipper lobsters. They are prevalent from Sydney all the way through to where are we? Moreton Bay, through to about just north of Fraser Island. They used to be something common and used for bait. Not anymore. They're an expensive commodity and the same price as lobsters over here.
Now, Hervey Bay is also in Queensland and is famous for scallops.
Yes. Yeah, Hervey Bay, they have some unbelievable scallops. They are used worldwide. They do ship them overseas. Again, very sweet. And if you talk to people, they say, but they have no roe on them. The reason that the roe is taken off after harvesting is the fact that the roe will actually permeate into the white of the scallop and leave pink tinges on the scallop. So in order to remove that, they shuck the scallop and debeard them straight away. So they are processed very quickly. And the scallop's beautiful flavour. We used them when we went to Washington, D.C. in 2003 and did a function there. They were extremely well received. It's completely different from scallops that you find in America and also in Scotland around the English coast. They don't have that salty tang. Again, they've got that beautiful, sweet, fleshy flavour, which is just a joy to work with.
Why don't you pick two or three dishes off your menu and sort of introduce them and then describe them for our listeners?
One of my favourites. We've got the Queensland scallops on. We always do have them on because they are so popular and people expect Queensland seafood. That we've teamed them up with green tea noodles. Now you're thinking, well, green tea noodles? Yes, you've got a hot scallop and you've got a room temperature green tea noodle. It has some seaweed. It has some small pearls of melon, rock melon, and also mango, which our Bowen mango is in season at the moment. They team extremely well. We use a Japanese citrus, a yuzu. We team that up with a little bit of sesame oil, and then a sprinkling of sesame seeds on the top, and that with some Chardonnay vinegar and some extra virgin olive oil. Very simple in execution, but the flavour, absolutely delicious. I mean, that's just one, which is, a very nice one, very, very customer friendly and extremely popular. Another one we do chicken with a sausage roll at the moment. And we call it chicken with a sausage roll, but it's a nice corn-fed breast. We roast that off, and then we serve it with a mousse, which chicken mousse, and in that we have some nuggets of sweetbread, some truffle, and some wood mushrooms, all sauteed off and then bound, and that's our sausage roll. And then just some Savoy cabbage, sweated off with just a little bit of vegetables and a Madeira sauce to go with it. Like I say, it's nouveau riche dining. It really, the ladies get a lot of fun out of it, and the gentlemen think it's the best sausage roll they've ever had in their life. Goes down a treat. Another one we have at the moment, mangoes are in season, and of course being tropical, we have lychees, we have some beautiful pineapples, which are nice and succulent and sweet, and Bathonga gold pineapples, what we call them here. We team that up with a finger lime syrup. Now, the finger limes, I think that they are actually a native for Queensland and parts of the Northern Territory, and they look like a lime caviar. They look like a finger, and when you cut them open, their flesh is all different colours. Now, you might get one or two finger limes that are ever the same out of millions, but they are in season now, and they just have a sensational fragrance about them. They make a beautiful cocktail, actually. And with that, we make a coconut ice cream, and we shave the mango very thinly, and then we wrap it around the coconut ice cream. So we call it like a mango ravioli, and then we use the finger lime syrup and the pineapple, some dice of mango, and some lychees. And lychees are in season now as well. And they grow just north of Harvey Bay in a place called Bundaberg, where we're famous for our rum. They are three dishes, I think, which are the epitome of restaurant two. Very simple, local produce. They work extremely well.
Listeners, don't you just want to get on a plane and come down here? I mean, it's only 8,000 miles away. You just absolutely have to come here. When you come to Australia, you've got a detour through Brisbane. It's really changed enormously. It's growing. It's vibrant. It's exciting. People are all over the place shopping, we noticed, well into the night, partly because the climate is so wonderful. David, give us some information about website and then quickly about your other project, which is called Three.
We are available, and then you can look us up on the website. It's www.restaurant2, that's the number 2.com.au. And you go in there, have a look, and see what our current menu is, see what we're doing at this present point in time, whether, you know, something about staff, something about new events. It might be some recipes that I produced for a local paper called Brisbane News. So we're fairly up to date on our website, and we scroll over. It will be probably within a couple of days of the new month starting, so we change menus every month. And
what about Three?
Three is a new venture that Michael and we've got a new business partner, Peter, have put together. It's predominantly red meat, so we sell 60% red meat, and it's kind of a comical take on a steakhouse. Very good service, simplistic food, and some beautiful red meat. For us, it's our version of family dining, and it's as we would like to do it ourselves. I mean, really, when it comes down to it, you want something that's user-friendly. Three Bistro is a user-friendly spot. It's a great place to go.
Does that have a separate website?
They do have a separate website. It's threebistro.com.au. Should get you in there with the current menu.
Listeners, you probably noticed a little bit of noise in the background. Chef David is in control of his restaurant because it's full, and he's sitting here talking to me. David, thank you so much for talking to On the Menu. And listeners, make a point of coming to Brisbane when you're in Australia, and make a point of going to two or three, and maybe at one point there'll be a one. David, a last thought?
Well, there could be a one, there could be a four, but two and three, we're doing so well. It's just nice to make contact with you, with everybody out there. And by all means, when you're in town, just say where you heard us, and you'll find us one of the most hospitable places in the world. Thank you.
Well, Rabbit, that's certainly plenty of eating and talking for this week. And I think that we ought to breathe a sigh of relief that we managed to cover it all.
And listeners, we'll see you again, same time, same place, next week.
Bye-bye.